with them that's got to be fixed, and I'll have my house, this here one, right beside my shop. That way I would have a bell and give 24-hour service.
Sounds like a good deal, I said. And it does.
Best thing about it, Joe went on, if business fell off, why, I'd just move on to where it was good.
His wife said,
Joe's got it all worked out on paper where everything's going to go. Every wrench and drill, even an electric welder. Joe's a wonderful welder.
I said, I'd take back what I said, Joe. I guess you've got your roots in a grease pit.
You could do worse. I even worked that out. And you know, when the kids grow up, we can even work our way south in the winter and north in the summer. Joe does good work, said his wife. He's got his own steady customers where he works. Some men come 50 miles to get Joe to work on their cars because he does good work.
I'm a real good mechanic, said Joe. Driving the big highway near Toledo, I had a conversation with Charlie on the subject of roots. He listened, but he didn't reply. In the pattern thinking about roots, I and most other people have left two things out of consideration. Could it be that Americans are a restless people, a mobile people, never satisfied with where they are as a matter of selection? The pioneers, the immigrants who peopled the continent, were the restless ones in Europe. The steady-rooted ones stayed home and are still there. But every one of us, except the Negroes forced here as slaves, are descended from the restless ones, the wayward ones who were not content to stay at home. Wouldn't it be unusual if we had not inherited this tendency? And the fact is that we have. But that's the short view. What are roots and how long have we had them? If our species has existed for a couple of million years, what is its history? Our remote ancestors followed the game, moved with the food supply, and fled from evil weather, from ice and the changing seasons. Then, after millennia, beyond thinking, they domesticated some animals so that they lived with their food supply. Then, of necessity, they followed the grass that fed their flocks in endless wanderings. Only when agriculture came into practice, and that's not very long ago in terms of the whole history, did a place achieve meaning and value and permanence. But land is a tangible, and tangibles have a way of getting into few hands. Thus it was that one man wanted ownership of land, and at the same time wanted servitude because someone had to work it. Roots were in ownership of land, intangible and immovable possessions. In this view, we are a restless species with a very short history of roots, and those not widely distributed. Perhaps we have overrated roots as a psychic need. Maybe the greater the urge, the deeper and more ancient is the need, the will, the hunger to be somewhere else. Charlie had no answer to my premise. Also, he was a mess. I had promised myself to keep him combed and clipped and beautiful and hadn't done it. His fur was bald and dirty. Poodles do not shed any more than sheep do. At night, when I had planned this virtuous grooming, I was always too busy with something else. Also, I discovered a dangerous allergy I didn't know I had. One night, I had pulled up at a trucker's park where huge cattle trucks put up and clean their beds. Around the park, there was a mountain of manure and a fog of flies. Although Rocinante was screened, the flies got in their millions and hid in corners and would not be dislodged. For the first time, I got out the bug bomb and sprayed heavily, and Charlie broke into a sneezing attack so violent and prolonged that I had finally to carry him out in my arms. In the morning, the cab was full of sleepy flies, and I sprayed it, and Charlie had another attack. After that, whenever flying visitors invaded, I had to close Charlie out and air out the house or cab after the pests were dead. I never saw such a severe allergy. Since I hadn't seen the Middle West for a long time, many impressions crowded in on me as I drove through Ohio and Michigan and Illinois. The first was the enormous increase in population. Villages had become towns, and towns had grown to cities. The roads squirmed with traffic. The cities were so dense with people that all attention had to be devoted to not hitting anyone or being hit. The next impression was of an electric energy, a force, almost a fluid of energy so powerful as to be stunning in its impact. No matter what the direction, whether for good or for bad, the vitality was everywhere. I don't think for a second that the people I had seen and talked to in New England were either unfriendly or discourteous, but they spoke tersely and usually waited for the newcomer to open communication. Almost on crossing the Ohio line, it seemed to me that people were more open and more outgoing. The waitress in a roadside stand said good morning before I had a chance to, discussed breakfast as though she liked the idea, spoke with enthusiasm about the weather, sometimes even offered some information about herself without my delving. Strangers talked freely to one another without caution. I had forgotten how rich and beautiful is the countryside, the deep topsoil, the wealth of great trees, the lake country of Michigan, handsome as a well-made woman, and dressed and jeweled. It seemed to me that the earth was generous and outgoing here in the heartland, and perhaps the people took a cue from it. One of my purposes was to listen, to hear speech, accent, speech rhythms, overtones, and emphasis. For speech is so much more than words and sentences. I did listen everywhere. It seemed to me that regional speech is in the process of disappearing. Not gone, but going. 40 years of radio and 20 years of television must have this impact. Communications must destroy localness by a slow, inevitable process. I can remember a time when I could almost pinpoint a man's place of origin by his speech. That is growing more difficult now, and will in some foreseeable future become impossible. It is a rare house or building that is not rigged with spiky combers of the air. Radio and television speech becomes standardized, perhaps better English than we have ever used. Just as our bread, mixed and baked, packaged and sold without benefit of accident or human frailty, is uniformly good and uniformly tasteless, so will our speech become one speech. I, who love words and the endless possibility of words, am saddened by this inevitability. For with local accent will disappear local tempo. The idioms, the figures of speech that make language rich and full of the poetry of place and time, must go. And in their place will be a national speech, wrapped and packaged, standard and tasteless. Localness is not gone, but it is going. In the many years since I have listened to the land, the change is very great. Traveling west along the northern routes, I did not hear a truly local speech until I reached Montana. That is one of the reasons I fell in love again with Montana. The West Coast went back to packaged English. The Southwest kept a grasp, but a slipping grasp, on localness. Of course, the Deep South holds on by main strength to its regional expressions, just as it holds and treasures some other anachronisms, but no region can hold out for long against the highway, the high-tension line, and the national television. What I am mourning is perhaps not worth saving, but I regret its loss nevertheless. Even while I protest the assembly line production of our food, our songs, our language, and eventually our souls, I know that it was a rare home that baked good bread in the old days. Mother's cooking was, with rare exceptions, poor. That good unpasteurized milk, touched only by flies and bits of manure, crawled with bacteria. The healthy old-time life was riddled with aches, sudden death from unknown causes. And that sweet, local speech I mourn was the child of illiteracy and ignorance. It is the nature of a man as he grows older, a small bridge in time, to protest against change, particularly change for the better. But it is true that we have exchanged corpulence for starvation, and either one will kill us. The lines of change are down. We, or at least I, can have no conception of human life and human thought in 100 years or 50 years. Perhaps my greatest wisdom is the knowledge that I do not know. The sad ones are those who waste their energy in trying to hold it back, for they can only feel bitterness in loss and no joy in gain. As I pass through or near the great hives of production, Youngstown, Cleveland, Akron, Toledo, Pontiac, Flint, and later South Bend and Gary, my eyes and mind were battered by the fantastic hugeness and energy of production, a complication that resembles chaos and cannot be. So might one look down on an anthill and see no method or direction or purpose in the darting, hurrying inhabitants. What was so wonderful was that I could come again to a quiet country road, tree-bordered, with fenced fields and cows, could pull up Rocinante beside a lake of clear, clean water and see high overhead the arrows of southing ducks and geese. There, Charlie could, with his delicate, exploring nose, read his own particular literature on bushes and tree trunks, and leave his message there, perhaps as important in endless time as these pen scratches I put down on perishable paper. There, in the quiet, with the wind flicking tree branches and distorting the water's mirror, I cooked improbable dinners in my disposable aluminum pans, made coffee so rich and sturdy it would float a nail, and, sitting on my own back doorsteps, could finally come to think about what I had seen and try to arrange some pattern of thought to accommodate the teeming crowds of my seeing and hearing. I'll tell you what it was like. Go to the Uffizi in Florence, the Louvre in Paris, and you're so crushed with the numbers, once the might of greatness, that you go away distressed, with a feeling like constipation. And then, when you are alone and remembering, the canvases sort themselves out. Some are eliminated by your taste or your limitations, but others stand up clear and clean. Then you can go back to look at one thing untroubled by the shouts of the multitude. After confusion, I can go into the Prado in Madrid and pass, unseeing, the 1,000 pictures shouting for my attention, and I can visit a friend, a not-large Greco, San Pablo con un libro. St. Paul has just closed his book. His finger marks the last page read, and on his face are the wonder and will to understand after the book is closed. Maybe understanding is possible only after. Years ago, when I used to work in the woods, it was said of lumbermen that they did their logging in the whorehouse and their sex in the woods. So I have to find my way through the exploding production lines of the Middle West while sitting alone beside a lake in northern Michigan. As I sat secure in the silence, a Jeep scuffed to a stop on the road and good Charlie left his work and roared. A young man in boots, corduroys, and a red and black check Mackinaw climbed out and strode near. He spoke in the harsh, unfriendly tone a man uses when he doesn't much like what he has to do. "Don't you know this land is posted? This is private property." Normally, his tone would have sparked a tinder in me. I would have flared an ugliness of anger, and he would then have been able to evict me with pleasure and good conscience. We might even have edged into a quarrel with passion and violence. That would be only normal, except that the beauty and the quiet made me slow to respond with resentment, and in my hesitation I lost it. I said, "I knew it must be private. I was about to look for someone to ask permission or maybe pay to rest here." "The owner don't want campers. They leave papers around and build fires." "I don't blame them. I know the mess they make. See that sign on that tree? No trespassing, hunting, fishing, camping." "Well," I said, "that sounds as if it means business. If it's your job to throw me off, you've got to throw me off. I'll go peacefully, but I've just made a pot of coffee. Do you think your boss would mind if I finished it? Would he mind if I offered you a cup? Then you could kick me off quicker." The young man grinned. "What the hell?" he said. "You don't build no fires, and you don't throw out no trash." I'm doing worse than that. I'm trying to bribe you with a cup of coffee. It's worse than that, too. I'm suggesting a dollop of old Granddad in the coffee. He laughed then.
What the hell? He said. Let me get my Jeep off the road.
Well, the whole pattern was broken. He squatted cross-legged in the pine needles on the ground and sipped his coffee. Charlie sniffed close and let himself be touched, and that's a rare thing for Charlie. He does not permit strangers to touch him. Just happens to be somewhere else. But this young man's fingers found the place behind the ears Charlie delights to have rubbed, and he sighed contentedly and sat down.
What you doing? Going hunting? I see your guns in the truck.
Just driving through. You know how you see a place and it's just right, and you're just tired enough, I guess you can't help stopping.
Yeah, he said. I know what you mean. You got a nice outfit.
I like it, and Charlie likes it.
Charlie? Never heard of a dog named Charlie. Hello, Charlie.
I wouldn't want to get you in trouble with your boss. Think I ought to drag ass now?
What the hell, he said. He ain't here. I'm in charge. You ain't doing no harm.
I'm trespassing.
Know something? Fella camped here, kind of a nut. So I came to kick him off. He said something funny. He says, trespassing ain't a crime, and it ain't a misdemeanor. He says it's a tort. Now what the hell does that mean? He was kind of a nut.
Search me, I said. I'm not a nut.
Let me warm up your coffee.
I warmed it two ways.
You make swell coffee, said my host.
Before it gets too dark, I've got to find a place to park.
Know any place up the road where they'll let me stay the night? If you pull over that way behind those pine trees, nobody could see you from the road.
But I'd be committing a tort.
Yeah, I wish to Christ I knew what that meant.
He drove ahead of me in the Jeep and helped me find a level place in the pine grove. And after dark, he came into Rosinante and admired her facilities, and we drank some whiskey together and had a nice visit and told each other a few lies. I showed him some fancy jigs and poppers I'd bought at Abercrombie and Fitch and gave him one. And I gave him some paperback thriller I'd finished with, all loaded with sex and sadism, and also a copy of Field and Stream. In return, he invited me to stay as long as I wished and said that he'd come by tomorrow and we'd do a little fishing. And I accepted for one day at least. It's nice to have friends. And besides, I wanted a little time to think about the things I'd seen, the huge factories and plants and the scurry and production. The guardian of the lake was a lonely man, the more so because he had a wife. He showed me her picture in a plastic shield in his wallet, a prettyish blonde girl trying her best to live up to the pictures in the magazines. A girl of products, home permanents, shampoos, rinses, skin conditioners. She hated being out in what she called the sticks. Longed for the great and gracious life in Toledo or South Bend. Her only company was found in the shiny pages of charm and glamour. Eventually she would sulk her way to success. Her husband would get a job in some great clanging organism of progress, and they would live happily ever after. All this came through in small, oblique spurts in his conversation. She knew exactly what she wanted, and he didn't. But his want would ache in him all his life. After he drove away in his Jeep, I lived his life for him, and it put a mist of despair on me. He wanted his pretty little wife, and he wanted something else, and he couldn't have both.
Charlie had a dream, so violent that he awakened me. His legs jerked in the motions of running, and he made little yipping cries. Perhaps he dreamed he'd chased some gigantic rabbit and couldn't quite catch it. Or maybe, in his dream, something chased him. On the second supposition, I put out my hand and awakened him, but the dream must have been strong. He muttered to himself and complained, and drank half a bowl of water before he went back to sleep. The guardian came back soon after sunup. He brought a rod, and I got out my own and rigged a spinning reel, and had to find my glasses to tie on the bright painted popper.
The monofilament line is transparent, said to be invisible to fish, and is completely invisible to me without my glasses. I said, "You know, I don't have a fishing license."
"What the hell?"
he said. "We probably won't catch anything anyway." And he was right. We didn't. We walked and cast and walked and did everything we knew to interest bass or pike. My friend kept saying, "They're right down there, if we could just get the message through." But we never did. If they were down there, they still are. A remarkable amount of fishing is like that, but I like it just the same. My wants are simple. I have no desire to latch onto a monstrous symbol of fate and prove my manhood in titanic Piscine war. But sometimes I do like a couple of cooperative fish of frying size. At noon, I refused an invitation to come to dinner and meet the wife. I was growing increasingly anxious to meet my own wife, so I hurried on. There was a time not too long ago when a man put out to sea and ceased to exist for 2 or 3 years or forever. And when the covered wagons set out to cross the continent, friends and relations remaining at home might never hear from the wanderers again. Life went on, problems were settled, decisions were taken. Even I can remember when a telegram meant just one thing, a death in the family. In one short lifetime, the telephone has changed all that. If in this wandering narrative I seem to have cut the cords of family joys and sorrows, of Junior's current delinquency and Junior Junior's new tooth, of business triumph and agony, it is not so. 3 times a week from some bar, supermarket, or tire and tool cluttered service station, I put calls through to New York and reestablished my identity in time and space. For 3 or 4 minutes I had a name, and the duties and joys and frustrations a man carries with him like a comet's tail. It was like dodging back and forth from one dimension to another, a silent explosion of breaking through a sound barrier, a curious experience, like a quick dip into a known but alien water. It was established that my wife was to fly out to meet me in Chicago for a short break in my journey. In 2 hours, in theory at least, she would slice through a segment of the earth it had taken me weeks to clamber over. I became impatient, stuck to a huge toll road that strings the northern border of Indiana, bypassed Elkhart and South Bend and Gary. The nature of the road describes the nature of the travel. The straightness of the way, the swish of traffic, the unbroken speed are hypnotic. And while the miles peel off, an imperceptible exhaustion sets in. Day and night are one. The setting sun is neither an invitation nor a command to stop, for the traffic rolls constantly. Late in the night, I pulled into a rest area, had a hamburger at the great lunch counter that never closes, and walked Charlie on the close-clipped grass. I slept an hour, but awakened long before daylight. I had brought city suits and shirts and shoes, but had forgotten to bring a suitcase to transport them from truck to hotel room. Indeed, I don't know where I could have stored a suitcase. In a garbage can under an arc light, I found a clean corrugated paper carton and packed my city clothes. I wrapped my clean white shirts in road maps and tied the carton with fishing line. Knowing my tendency to panic in the roar and crush of traffic, I started into Chicago long before daylight. I wanted to end up at the Ambassador East, where I had reservations, and, true to form, ended up lost. Finally, in a burst of invention, I hired an all-night taxi to lead me, and sure enough, I had passed very near my hotel. If the doorman and bellhops found my means of traveling unusual, they gave no sign. I handed out my suits on hangers, my shoes in the game pocket of a hunting coat, and my shirts in their neat wrapping of New England road maps. Rosinante was whisked away to a garage for storage. Charlie had to go to a kennel to be stored, bathed, and Hollanderized. Even at his age, he is a vain dog and loves to be beautified. But when he found he was to be left, and in Chicago, his ordinary aplomb broke down and he cried out in rage and despair. I closed my ears and went away quickly to my hotel. I think I am well and favorably known at the Ambassador East, but this need not apply when I arrive in wrinkled hunting clothes, unshaven and lightly crusted with the dirt of travel, and bleary-eyed from driving most of the night. Certainly I had a reservation, but my room might not be vacated until noon. The hotel's position was explained to me carefully. I understood it and forgave the management. My own position was that I would like a bath and a bed, but since that was impossible, I would simply pile up in a chair in the lobby and go to sleep until my room was ready. I saw in the desk man's eyes his sense of uneasiness. Even I knew I would be no ornament to this elegant and expensive pleasure dome. He signaled an assistant manager, perhaps by telepathy, and all together we worked out a solution. A gentleman had just checked out to catch an early airplane. His room was not cleaned and prepared, but I was welcome to use it until mine was ready. Thus, the problem was solved by intelligence and patience, and each got what he wanted. I had my chance at a hot bath and a sleep, and the hotel was spared the mischance of having me in the lobby. The room had not been touched since its former occupant had left. I sank into a comfortable chair to pull off my boots and even got one of them off before I began to notice things, and then more things, and more. In a surprisingly short time, I forgot the bath and the sleep and found myself deeply involved with Lonesome Harry. An animal resting or passing by leaves crushed grass, footprints, and perhaps droppings. But a human occupying a room for one night prints his character, his biography, his recent history, and sometimes his future plans and hopes. I further believe that personality seeps into walls and is slowly released. This might well be an explanation of ghosts and such manifestations. Although my conclusions may be wrong, I seem to be sensitive to the spore of the human. Also, I am not shy about admitting that I am an incorrigible peeping Tom. I have never passed an unshaded window without looking in, have never closed my ears to a conversation that was none of my business. I can justify, or even dignify, this by protesting that in my trade I must know about people. But I suspect that I am simply curious. As I sat in this unmade room, Lonesome Harry began to take shape and dimension. I could feel that recently departed guest in the bits and pieces of himself he had left behind. Of course, Charlie, even with his imperfect nose, would have known more. But Charlie was in a kennel preparing to be clipped. Even so, Harry is as real to me as anyone I ever met, and more real than many. He is not unique, in fact, is a member of a fairly large group. Therefore, he becomes of interest in any investigation of America. Before I begin to patch him together, lest a number of men grow nervous, let me declare that his name is not Harry. He lives in Westport, Connecticut. This information comes from the laundry strips from several shirts. A man usually lives where he has his shirts laundered. I only suspect that he commutes to work in New York. His trip to Chicago was primarily a business trip with some traditional pleasures thrown in. I know his name because he signed it a number of times on hotel stationery, each signature with a slightly different slant. This seems to indicate that he is not entirely sure of himself in the business world, but there were other signs of that. He started a letter to his wife, which also ended in the wastebasket. Darling, everything is going okay. Tried to call your aunt, but no answer. I wish you were here with me. This is a lonesome town. You forgot to put in my cufflinks. I bought a cheap pair at Marshall Field. I'm writing this while I wait for C.E. to call. Hope he brings the It's just as well that Darling didn't drop in to make Chicago less lonesome for Harry. His guest was not C.E. with a contract. She was a brunette and wore a very pale lipstick, cigarette butts in the ashtray, and on the edge of a highball glass. They drank Jack Daniels, a whole bottle. The empty bottle, 6 soda bottles, and a tub that had held ice cubes. She used a heavy perfume and did not stay the night. The second pillow used, but not slept on. Also no lipstick on discarded tissues. I like to think her name was Lucille. I don't know why. Maybe because it was and is. She was a nervous friend. Smoked Harry's recessed, filtered cigarettes, but stubbed each one out, only one-third smoked, and lighted another. And she didn't put them out. She crushed them, frayed the ends. Lucille wore one of those little smidgens of hats held on by interned combs. One of the combs broke loose. That and a bobby pin beside a bed told me Lucille is a brunette. I don't know whether or not Lucille is professional, but at least she is practiced. There is a fine business-like quality about her. She didn't leave too many things around, as an amateur might. Also, she didn't get drunk. Her glass was empty, but the vase of red roses, courtesy of the management, smelled of Jack Daniels, and it didn't do them any good. I wonder what Harry and Lucille talked about. I wonder whether she made him less lonesome. Somehow I doubt it. I think both of them were doing what was expected of them. Harry shouldn't have slugged his drinks. His stomach isn't up to it. Tom's wrapper's in the wastebasket. I guess his business is a sensitive one and hard on the stomach. Lonesome Harry must have finished the bottle after Lucille left. He had a hangover. Two foil tubes of bromo seltzer in the bathroom. Three things haunted me about Lonesome Harry. First, I don't think he had any fun. Second, I think he was really lonesome, maybe in a chronic state. And third, he didn't do a single thing that couldn't be predicted, didn't break a glass or a mirror, committed no outrages, left no physical evidence of joy. I had been hobbling around with one boot off, finding out about Harry. I even looked under the bed and in the closet. He hadn't even forgotten a tie. I felt sad about Harry. Part 3. Chicago was a break in my journey, a resumption of my name, identity, and happy marital status. My wife flew in from the East for a brief visit. I was delighted at the change, back to my known and trusted life, but here I run into a literary difficulty. Chicago broke my continuity. This is permissible in life, but not in writing. So I leave Chicago out, because it is off the line, out of drawing. In my travels, it was pleasant and good. In writing, it would contribute only a disunity. When that time was over and the goodbyes said, I had to go through the same lost loneliness all over again, and it was no less painful than at first. There seemed to be no cure for loneliness, save only being alone. Charlie was torn three ways, with anger at me for leaving him, with gladness at the sight of Rosinante, and with pure pride in his appearance. For when Charlie is groomed and clipped and washed, he is as pleased with himself as is a man with a good tailor or a woman newly patinaed by a beauty parlor, all of whom can believe they are like that clear through. Charlie's combed columns of legs were noble things. His cap of silver-blue fur was rakish, and he carried the pom-pom of his tail like the baton of a bandmaster. A wealth of combed and clipped mustache gave him the appearance and attitude of a French rake of the 19th century, and incidentally concealed his crooked front teeth. I happen to know what he looks like without the tailoring. One summer, when his fur grew matted and mildewed, I clipped into the skin. Under those sturdy towers of legs are spindly shanks, thin and not too straight. With his chest ruff removed, one can see the sagging stomach of the middle-aged. But if Charlie was aware of his deep-down inadequacy, he gave no sign. If manners maketh man, then manner and grooming maketh poodle. He sat straight and nobly in the seat of Rosinante and gave me to understand that while forgiveness was not impossible, I would have to work for it. He's a fraud, and I know it. Once, when our boys were little and in summer camp, we paid them the deadly parents' visit. When we were about to depart, a lady parent told us she had to leave quickly to keep her child from going into hysterics. And with brave but trembling lips, she fled blindly, masking her feeling to save her child. The boy watched her go, and then with infinite relief went back to his gang and his business, knowing that he too had played the game. And I know for a fact that 5 minutes after I had left Charlie, he had found new friends and had made his arrangements for his comfort. But one thing Charlie did not fake. He was delighted to be traveling again, and for a few days he was an ornament to the trip. Illinois did a fair autumn day for us, crisp and clean. We moved quickly northward, heading from Wisconsin through a noble land of good fields and magnificent trees, a gentleman's countryside, neat and white-fenced, and I would guess subsidized by outside income. It did not seem to me to have the thrust of land that supports itself and its owner. Rather, it was like a beautiful woman who requires the support and help of many faceless ones just to keep going. But this fact does not make her less lovely, if you can afford her. It is possible, even probable, to be told a truth about a place, to accept it, to know it, and at the same time not to know anything about it. I had never been to Wisconsin, but all my life I had heard about it, had eaten its cheeses, some of them as good as any in the world, and I must have seen pictures. Everyone must have. Why, then, was I unprepared for the beauty of this region, for its variety of field and hill, forest and lake? I think now I must have considered it one big level cow pasture because of the state's enormous yield of milk products. I never saw a country that changed so rapidly, and because I had not expected it, everything I saw brought a delight. I don't know how it is in other seasons. The summers may reek and rock with heat, the winters may groan with dismal cold, but when I saw it for the first and only time in early October, the air was rich with butter-colored sunlight. Not fuzzy, but crisp and clear so that every frost-gay tree was set off. The rising hills were not compounded, but alone and separate. There was a penetration of the light into solid substance so that I seemed to see into things, deep in, and I've seen that kind of light elsewhere only in Greece. I remembered now that I had been told Wisconsin is a lovely state, but the telling had not prepared me. It was a magic day. The land dripped with richness, the fat cows and pigs gleaming against green and, in the smaller holdings, corn standing in little tents as corn should, and pumpkins all about. I don't know whether or not Wisconsin has a cheese-tasting festival, but I, who am a lover of cheese, believe it should. Cheese was everywhere. Cheese centers, cheese cooperatives, cheese stores and stands, perhaps even cheese ice cream. I can believe anything, since I saw a score of signs advertising Swiss cheese candy. It is sad that I didn't stop to sample Swiss cheese candy. Now I can't persuade anyone that it exists, that I did not make it up. Beside the road, I saw a very large establishment, the greatest distributor of seashells in the world, and this in Wisconsin, which hasn't known a sea since the pre-Cambrian times. But Wisconsin is loaded with surprises. I had heard of the Wisconsin Dells, but was not prepared for the weird country sculptured by the Ice Age, a strange, gleaming country of water and carved rock, black and green. To awaken here might make one believe in a dream of some other planet, for it has a non-earthly quality, or else the engraved record of a time when the world was much younger and much different. Clinging to the sides of the dreamlike waterways was the litter of our times. The motels, the hot dog stands, the merchants of the cheap and mediocre and tawdry so loved by summer tourists. But these incrustations were closed and boarded against the winter, and even open, I doubt they could dispel the enchantment of the Wisconsin Dells. I stopped that night on a hilltop that was a trucker's place, but of a special kind. Here the gigantic cattle trucks rested and scraped out the residue left by their recent cargoes. There were mountains of manure, and over them mushroom clouds of flies. Charlie moved about smiling and sniffing ecstatically like an American woman in a French perfume shop. I can't bring myself to criticize his taste. Some people like one thing, and some another. The odors were rich and earthy, but not disgusting. As the evening deepened, I walked with Charlie among his mountains of delight to the brow of the hill and looked down on the little valley below. It was a disturbing sight. I thought too much driving had distorted my vision or addled my judgment, for the dark earth below seemed to move and pulse and breathe. It was not water, but it rippled like a black liquid. I walked quickly down the hill to iron out the distortion. The valley floor was carpeted with turkeys. It seemed like millions of them, so densely packed that they covered the earth. It was a great relief. Of course, this was a reservoir for Thanksgiving. To mill so close together is in the nature of turkeys in the evening. I remembered how on the ranch in my youth the turkeys gathered and roosted in clots in the cypress trees, out of reach of wildcats and coyotes. The only indication I know of that turkeys have any intelligence at all. To know them is not to admire them, for they are vain and hysterical. They gather in vulnerable groups and then panic at rumors. They are subject to all the sicknesses of other fowl, together with some they have invented. Turkeys seem to be manic depressive types, gobbling with blushing wattles, spread tails, and scraping wings in amorous bravado at one moment and huddled in craven cowardice the next. It is hard to see how they can be related to their wild, clever, suspicious cousins. But here, in their thousands, they carpeted the earth, waiting to lie on their backs on the platters of America. I know it is a shame that I had never seen the noble twin cities of St. Paul and Minneapolis, but how much greater a disgrace that I still haven't, although I went through them. As I approached, a great surf of traffic engulfed me, waves of station wagons, riptides of roaring trucks. I wonder why it is that when I plan a route too carefully, it goes to pieces, whereas if I blunder along in blissful ignorance, aimed in a fancied direction, I get through with no trouble. In the early morning, I had studied maps, drawn a careful line along the way I wished to go. I still have that arrogant plan, into St. Paul on Highway 10, then gently across the Mississippi. The S-curve in the Mississippi here would give me 3 crossings of the river. After this pleasant jaunt, I meant to go through Golden Valley, drawn by its name. That seems simple enough, and perhaps it can be done, but not by me. First, the traffic struck me like a tidal wave and carried me along, a bit of shiny flotsam bounded in front by a gasoline truck half a block long. Behind me was an enormous cement mixer on wheels, its big howitzer revolving as it proceeded. On my right was what I judged to be an atomic cannon. As usual, I panicked and got lost. Like a weakening swimmer, I edged to the right into a pleasant street, only to be stopped by a policeman, who informed me that trucks and such vermin were not permitted there. He thrust me back into the ravening stream. I drove for hours, never able to take my eyes from the surrounding mammoths. I must have crossed the river, but I couldn't see it. I never did see it. I never saw St. Paul or Minneapolis. All I saw was a river of trucks. All I heard was a roar of motors. The air, saturated with diesel fumes, burned in my lungs. Charlie got a coughing fit, and I couldn't take time to pat him on the back. At a red light, I saw that I was on an evacuation route. It took some time for that to penetrate. My head was spinning. I had lost all sense of direction, but the sign's evacuation route continued. Of course, it is the planned escape route from the bomb that hasn't been dropped. Here in the middle of the Middle West, an escape route, a road designed by fear. In my mind, I could see it because I have seen people running away. The roads clogged to a standstill and the stampede over the cliff of our own designing. And suddenly, I thought of that valley of the turkeys and wondered how I could have the gall to think turkeys stupid. Indeed, they have an advantage over us. They're good to eat.
It took me nearly 4 hours to get through the Twin Cities. I've heard that some parts of them are beautiful, and I never found Golden Valley. Charlie was no help. He wasn't involved with a race that could build a thing and had to escape from. He didn't want to go to the moon just to get the hell away from it all. Confronted with our stupidities, Charlie accepts them for what they are. Stupidities. Sometime in these bedlam hours, I must have crossed the river again because I had got back on US 10 and was moving north on the east side of the Mississippi. The country opened out, and I stopped at a roadside restaurant, exhausted. It was a German restaurant complete with sausages, sauerkraut, and beer steins hanging in rows over the bar, shining but unused. I was the only customer at that time of day. The waitress was no Brunhild, but a lean, dark-faced little thing, either a young and troubled girl or a very spry old woman, I couldn't tell which. I ordered bratwurst and sauerkraut and distinctly saw the cook unwrap a sausage from a cellophane slipcover and drop it in boiling water. The beer came in a can. The bratwurst was terrible, and the kraut an insulting, watering mess. "I wonder if you can help me?" I asked the young, ancient waitress.
"What's your trouble?"
"I guess I'm a little lost."
"How do you mean lost?" she said.
The cook leaned through his window and rested bare elbows on the serving counter. "I want to go to Sauk Center, and I don't seem to be getting there."
"Where you come from?"
"Minneapolis."
"And what you doing this side of the river?"
"Well, I seem to have got lost in Minneapolis, too." She looked at the cook.
"He got lost in Minneapolis," she said.
"Nobody can get lost in Minneapolis," the cook said. "I was born there, I know."
The waitress said, "I come from St. Cloud, and I can't get lost in Minneapolis." "I guess I brought some new talent to it, but I want to go to Sauk Center." The cook said,
"If he can stay on a road, he can't get lost. You're on 52. Cross over at St. Cloud and stay on 52.
"Is Sauk Center on 52?
"Ain't no place else. You must be a stranger around here getting lost in Minneapolis. I couldn't get lost blindfolded."
I said a little snappishly, "Could you get lost in Albany or San Francisco?"
"I never been there, but I bet I wouldn't get lost."
"I've been to Duluth," the waitress said. "And Christmas I'm going to Sioux Falls. I got an aunt there."
"Ain't you got relatives in Sauk Center?"
the cook asked. "Sure, but that's not so far away. Like he says, San Francisco. My brother's in the Navy. He's in San Diego. You got relations in Sauk Center?"
"No, I just want to see it."
"Sinclair Lewis came from there."
"Oh, yeah, they got a sign up. I guess quite a few folks come to see it. It does the town some good."
"He's the first man who told me about this part of the country."
"Who is?"
"Sinclair Lewis."
"Oh, yeah, you know him?"
"No, I just read him." I'm sure she was going to say, "Who?" But I stopped her. "You say I cross at St. Cloud and stay on 52? The cook said,
"I don't think, what's-his-name is there anymore."
"I know. He's dead."
"You don't say."
There was a sign in Sauk Center, all right. Birthplace of Sinclair Lewis. For some reason, I went through there fast and turned north on 71 to Wadena, and it got dark and I pounded on to Detroit Lakes. There was a face before me, a lean and shriveled face like an apple too long in a barrel, a lonely face and sick with loneliness. I didn't know him well, never knew him in the boisterous days when he was called Red. Toward the end of his life, he called me several times in New York, and we would have lunch at the Algonquin. I called him Mr. Lewis. Still do in my mind. He didn't drink anymore and took no pleasure in his food, but now and then his eyes would glitter with steel. I had read Main Street when I was in high school, and I remember the violent hatred it aroused in the countryside of his nativity. Did he go back? Just went through now and again. The only good writer was a dead writer. Then he couldn't surprise anyone anymore, couldn't hurt anyone anymore.
And the last time I saw him, he seemed to have shriveled even more. He said, "I'm cold. I seem to be always cold. I'm going to Italy." And he did, and he died there. And I don't know whether or not it's true, but I've heard he died alone. And now he's good for the town, brings in some tourists. He's a good writer now. If there had been room in Rosinante, I would have packed the WPA Guides to the States, all 48 volumes of them. I have all of them, and some are very rare. If I remember correctly, North Dakota printed only 800 copies, and South Dakota, about 500. The complete set comprises the most comprehensive account of the United States ever got together, and nothing since has even approached it. It was compiled during the Depression by the best writers in America, who were, if that is possible, more depressed than any other group while maintaining their inalienable instinct for eating. But these books were detested by Mr. Roosevelt's opposition. If WPA workers leaned on their shovels, the writers leaned on their pens. The result was that in some states, the plates were broken up after a few copies were printed. And that is a shame because they were reservoirs of organized, documented, and well-written information, geological, historical, and economic. If I had carried my guides along, for example, I would have looked up Detroit Lakes, Minnesota, where I stopped, and I would have known why it is called Detroit Lakes, who named it, when, and why. I stopped near there late at night, and so did Charlie, and I don't know any more about it than he does. The next day, a long-cultivated ambition was to blossom and fruit. Curious how a place unvisited can take such hold on the mind, so that the very name sets up a ringing. To me, such a place was Fargo, North Dakota. Perhaps its first impact is in the name Wells Fargo, but my interest certainly goes beyond that. If you will take a map of the United States and fold it in the middle, eastern edge against western, and crease it sharply, right in the crease will be Fargo. On double-page maps, sometimes Fargo gets lost in the binding. That may not be a very scientific method for finding the east-west middle of the country, but it will do. But beyond this, Fargo to me is brother to the fabulous places of the earth, kin to those magically remote spots mentioned by Herodotus and Marco Polo and Mandeville. From my earliest memory, if it was a cold day, Fargo was the coldest place on the continent. If heat was the subject, then at that time the papers listed Fargo as hotter than any place else, or wetter, or drier, or deeper in snow. That's my impression, anyway. But I know that a dozen or half a hundred towns will rise up in injured wrath to denounce me with claims and figures for having much more dreadful weather than Fargo. I apologize to them in advance. As a sop to hurt feelings, I must admit that when I passed through Moorhead, Minnesota, and rattled across the Red River into Fargo on the other side, it was a golden autumn day. The town is traffic-troubled, as neon-plastered, as cluttered and milling with activity as any other up-and-coming town of 46,000 souls. The countryside was no different from Minnesota over the river. I drove through the town as usual, seeing little but the truck ahead of me and the Thunderbird in my rearview mirror. It's bad to have one's myth shaken up like that. Would Samarkand or Cathay or Cipango have suffered the same fate if visited? As soon as I had cleared the outskirts, the broken metal and glass outer ring, and moved through Mapleton, I found a pleasant place to stop on the Maple River not far from Alice. What a wonderful name for a town. Alice. It had 162 inhabitants in 1950 and 124 at the last census. And so much for the population explosion at Alice. Anyway, on the Maple River, I drew into a little copse of sycamores, I think, that overhung the stream, and paused to lick my mythological wounds. And I found with joy that the fact of Fargo had in no way disturbed my mind's picture of it. I could still think of Fargo as I always had. Blizzard-riven, heat-blasted, dust-rattled. I am happy to report that in the war between reality and romance, reality is not the stronger. Although it was only mid-morning, I cooked a sumptuous dinner for myself, but I don't remember what it was. And Charlie, who still had vestiges of his Chicago grooming, waded in the water and became his old dirty self again. After the comfort and the company of Chicago, I had to learn to be alone again. It takes a little time, but there on the Maple River, not far from Alice, the gift of it was coming back. Charlie had forgiven me in a nauseatingly superior way, but now he had settled down to business also. The pull-out place beside the water was pleasant. I brought out my garbage can washing machine and rinsed clothes that had been jiggling in detergent for 2 days. And then, because a pleasant breeze was blowing, I spread my sheets to dry in some low bushes. I don't know what kind of bushes they were, but the leaves had a rich smell like sandalwood, and there's nothing I like better than scented sheets. And I made some notes on a sheet of yellow paper on the nature and quality of being alone. These notes would, in the normal course of events, have been lost, as notes are always lost, but these particular notes turned up long afterward, wrapped around a bottle of ketchup, and secured with a rubber band. The first note says, "Relationship time to aloneness." And I remember about that. Having a companion fixes you in time, and that the present. But when the quality of aloneness settles down, past, present, and future all flow together. A memory, a present event, and a forecast all equally present. The second note lies obscurely under a streak of ketchup or catsup. But the third is electric. It says, "Reversion to pleasure-pain basis." And this is from some observation of another time. A number of years ago, I had some experience with being alone. For 2 succeeding years, I was alone each winter for 8 months at a stretch in the Sierra Nevada mountains on Lake Tahoe. I was a caretaker on a summer estate during the winter months when it was snowed in. And I made some observations then. As the time went on, I found that my reactions thickened. Ordinarily, I am a whistler. I stop whistling. I stop conversing with my dogs, and I believe that subtleties of feeling began to disappear until finally I was on a pleasure-pain basis. Then it occurred to me that the delicate shades of feeling, of reaction, are the result of communication, and without such communication they tend to disappear. A man with nothing to say has no words. Can its reverse be true? A man who has no one to say anything to has no words, as he has no need for words. Now and then there appear accounts of babies raised by animals, wolves and such. It is usually reported that the youngster crawls on all fours, makes those sounds learned from his foster parents, and perhaps even thinks like a wolf. Only through imitation do we develop toward originality. Take Charlie, for example. He is always associated with the learned, the gentle, the literate, and the reasonable, both in France and in America. And Charlie is no more like a dog than he is like a cat. His perceptions are sharp and delicate, and he is a mind reader. I don't know that he can read the thoughts of other dogs, but he can read mine. Before a plan is half formed in my mind, Charlie knows about it, and he also knows whether he is to be included in it. There's no question about this. I know too well his look of despair and disapproval when I've just thought that he must be left at home. And so much for the three notes below the red stain on the ketchup bottle. Soon Charlie moved downstream and found some discarded bags of garbage, which he went through with discrimination. He nosed over an empty bean can, sniffed in its opening, and rejected it. Then he took up the paper bag in his teeth and gently shook it so that more treasures rolled out, among them a balled-up piece of heavy white paper. I opened it and smoothed the angry creases from its surface. It was a court order addressed to Jack so-and-so, informing him that if he didn't pay his back alimony, he would be in contempt and punishable. The court sat in an eastern state, and this was North Dakota. Some poor guy on the lam. He shouldn't have left this spore around, in case anyone was looking for him. I snapped my Zippo lighter and burned the evidence with the full knowledge that I compounded the contempt. Good Lord, the trails we leave. Suppose someone, finding the ketchup bottle, tried to reconstruct me from my notes. I helped Charlie sort over the garbage, but there was no other written material, only the containers of prepared foods. The man was no cook. He lived out of cans, but then perhaps his former wife did also. It was only shortly after noon, but I was so relaxed and comfortable that I hated to move. "Should we stay the night, Charlie?" He inspected me and wagged his tail.